Coming up on This Week on Broadway, we chat with Uta Lemper. We talk about Broadway Con. Reviews include Our Mother's Brief Affair and La Boheme at the Met. That plus some news. Please stay tuned.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz, start the car, I know a whoopee spot. Well, the gin is cold, but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl. And all that jazz.
Hello and welcome to This Week on Broadway for Monday, January 25th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk on Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
With us this evening, we have a very special guest. Uta Lemper is with us. Broadway fans will know Uta from Chicago, and fans around the world know her from so many different stage and screen appearances and on their radios and on their iPods and their headphones all over, including a 2012 Grammy nomination for Paris Days and Berlin Nights. So Uta, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for your lovely introduction.
Well, you've done so much, and it's just, how do we encompass it?
And yet it seems so little. It's all relative, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is.
Well, see you have an album called Nine Secrets, and I see secret number six seems to be sex. Why don't we get
that?
Yeah.
Who is the dirty man asking this question? Well, let me first get to the point that it seems so much, yet I have to say it does not seem much to me. It is 35 years of living music and loving music, stage recordings and CDs and movies and et cetera. And yet it's a long journey. It's a long journey with so many chapters. But they all don't happen at once. They happen, you know, in succession, and they develop, they evolve one out of the other one, and inspired by the previous project, by new collaborations, people you meet, by things that happen to you in life. And it's just this amazing, unbelievable journey that we all take, and you know, trying to be courageous to realize the dreams that we have. And that's what I do with my musical project. Mainly, yes, you do know me from Chicago, which was a more high-profile commercial event in my life. But certainly, you know, there were so many other things that I did that were maybe not as commercial, but that meant even a lot more to me than, you know, the more recognized popular things.
Well, I'm going to guess that means Kurt Vile, because you've done so much Kurt Vile.
Kurt Vile is, Kurt Vile, we have to go back to 1987, when Universal launched this big recording project of degenerate music, the music that was banned by the Nazis.
Yes.
And I was the protagonist of this whole series of recordings, re-recordings for the first time of all the original Kurt Vile and the original arrangements, first time since the 50s, since Lotte Lenya had done her later recordings of her life back after the war in Paris. And this was an incredible project. It was still the time that the classical companies were able to... sorry, this is my ear is banging against this phone. I'm going to take it off right now. Oh, one. Here we go. getting on my nerves. The earring is gone. And I was wondering, what is hammering against the phone? Is it my teeth? No, it is the earring.
I always take mine off before I start.
Yes, yeah, take your teeth out.
Yes.
So this was an amazing recording series that only was really finished by the end of the 90s. It took almost 10, 15 years to finish this recording series. And yes, so this was a wave of revival of the music of Kurt Weill, and it was for me a perfect, fantastic platform to explore this music of my country of an incredible time, the Weimar Republic, and at the same time to open up the dialogue again with this country, with these absolute complex and unbelievable heritage of crime and world wars and Holocaust and all of this. And it was an important, complicated, also painful step to do. Mm-hmm. But I was launched in the middle of it, into it, and I was really took this to my heart, and it became a mission to me to represent and to be a post-war German young artist to bring this music back to life. And it really was sold all over the world, worldwide, and I stood up and I confronted this mission and did it with the best responsibility.
In fact, I was going to ask, indeed, when you were doing Cabaret as Sally Bowles, who, of course, is not a German, mm-hmm. Did people come up to you after Cabaret and say, boy, I remember those times, anything like that?
Who should come up to me?
I'm talking about people who saw the show.
Well, this was 1987 in Paris, mm-hmm. and I was already in the middle of this recording project. This was launched at the same time, parallelly, a recording mm-hmm. a career and a stage career. So the musical had really nothing to do with my recordings of Kurt Weill. This was a separate experience, and people who knew me from the Kurt Weill recordings, they thought I was the Kurt Weill interpreter, had no idea that actually uh-huh. I was also a theater actress, a dancer, uh-huh. and, you know, in musicals and having a completely different stage identity than the Kurt Weill. So, yes, I mean, that was an incredible year to perform Sally Bowles in Paris. It was the French production of Jérôme Savary. And, well, Sally Bowles is a British character, so I wasn't supposed to have any German accent in this. But I had to do the whole show in French. All the dialogue was in French. Very difficult for me at the time. And thank God the songs were in English.
I'm reading that you dubbed the voices of Ariel in The Little Mermaid and Esmeralda in the Hunchback of Notre Dame for the films. Mm. So what was it like to be a Disney heroine?
Well, this was amazing. I got a lot of thousands of letters from little German girls who thought I was the most beautiful, wonderful, well-figured thing with a fishtail and long red hair. And I had to unfortunately admit that I didn't have long red hair, and neither did I have a fishtail, long legs rather. And but it was such a beautiful song, and yes, and it's still identified with me. People still talk about it, and at the time I was very young still. Now then, finally, my kids figured out that I was the Ariel with the German voice, and they were very enchanted by this. But to go back to the Cabaret thing, actually, the opening night, believe it or not, in the first row, 1987 in Paris, there was Liza Minnelli sitting. And Joel Grey in the front row. And I was 22, and I said, this can't be, pinch me, it's impossible. But thank God I was too innocent not to be really frightened, and I said, okay, I'm gonna go for this, and yeah, I'm just gonna go for it. And I just remembered all those years in my teenage years when I was listening to the recording of the movie with Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey in Little Münster, Germany, in this big apartment building where we lived, singing with the record loud and, you know, heartful and shamelessly until the neighbors would knock, the German neighbors, you know, imagine them, knock at the doors,
shut up, you know, be quiet. We want to see the sports news, you know, Saturday night at 6 o'clock. And I upset the entire apartment building where I grew up in with my singing and copying Liza Minnelli. And then finally, 10 years later, she was watching me, and she was very lovely. I remember we met a few times after this at various concerts and performances, and it was a big honor for me.
You did you did Chicago on the West End in New York and in Vegas with Cheetah Rivera. So, you know, what was it like all three different places? And you had lots of different Billies. Tell us who your favorite Billies were. Can you?
Well, the first experience was the opening of the show in London. And obviously that was the most important because I created the part of Velma in London. And Henry Goodman was the really super unbelievable actor, straightforward actor with integrity, who completely freaked out that he had to sing on stage, and he was full of angst. And he made the Billy Flynn like fantastic and you know, full of intelligence and wit. Of course, I would say that was one of the most intelligent Billies, and. Yes, probably my favorite, because we became such great friends, and I adore him in all the movies. He's in so many movies, and I just find him an incredible man and actor of integrity. But it was an unbelievable ride. I moved to London from Paris with my two little children at the time, and now we are talking 1997, 10 years later after Paris. Mm-hmm. And another Kander and Ebb musical. But Kander and Ebb, believe it or not, I met for the first time here in New York in 1987, briefly before I played cabaret in Paris. I met them here at my very first performance in the Alice Tully Hall in New York, and it was a Kurt Weill performance. And I sang the Barber song and a bunch of songs. And as we know, and they're so much inspired by the Three Penny Opera in their musicals, they adored the Kurt Weill repertoire and the interpretation. And that's when we met for the very first time and met with the Kurt Weill Foundation here in New York. And we stayed in contact and was so pleased to finally play in their musicals. Cabaret and Chicago, definitely, absolutely my cup of tea musicals, because there is a little Three Penny Opera and a lot of Bertolt Brecht hidden inside those shows. And it was fantastic. I mean, Velma Kelly, I loved the dancing. I hadn't danced for a while at that time, and just had my second daughter at the moment. I really had to get back in shape, and it was quickly. And the Bob Fosse style was just absolutely my cup of tea, too. It was great to work with Anne Reinken and the original team, because it was just the second production in the world at the time, a year after opening here in New York. It was amazing. In the beginning, I thought, oh, my God, I can't do this. This is slapstick. And where is the depth? Where is the emotional depth? Where is, you know, the part to interpret? Roxy has a part to interpret. There's some, you know, moment of interior life in this person, Roxy. But Velma is just all crazy, slapstick, outgoing, dancing, up and down in the chair, split up in the air, and jump on the guy and kill another man. So it was kind of a challenging, and I said, okay, can we stop here for a minute? This is hectic. But then I understood this is the part, so I just went for it with all my guts, and was incredibly honored to get from the British community the Laurence Olivier Award, ever, the first time ever distributed to a German. This was must have hurt a lot, you know, because it was, yes, because I tell you, growing up in Europe and during the years of the Cold War in the 80s, this triangle between Paris, Berlin, and London, where I moved every other year and I lived in this triangle, it was this just growing together Europe. It was before the euro. And, you know, had wallets with different currencies in my pocket. And it was still a lot of digestion of World War II with everything and a lot of stigma in those years, even to be a German. And it was quite something to take that path and to be accepted and loved by the British theater community. I was just completely touched by it.
Well, that cast album, that cast recording is so fantastic.
Yes,
it really is wonderful. With Ruthie
Henschel. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were all like spot on with the singing. And I remember the recording session. And it was a very wonderful team to work in. And then I came to Broadway, and I was really super happy to be here. I had a green card already, so it wasn't an issue because I was married to an American husband, my first one at that time. And but he got retired.
Everybody has to go through stages like that. Yes,
there we go. That brings us finally to the Paulo Coelho recording, right? No, but not
yes.
yet. But,
yes.
But finally, I moved here with my entire family, and the Weislers were very nice with me, and invited everyone over and started schools, American schools, and I really liked it here in New York. I have to say, immediately, it was such a change from even the years in Paris. I thought, at the end of the day, that there's so much arrogance in this French thing, snobism. And the British can also be so uptight about so many things. And the Germans are way too German to me to live there. Being in New York at the end, it felt like, wow, this is great. This is where I want to be. I want to be surrounded by these people from everywhere. Everyone who calls himself a New Yorker is really not from here, but brings this incredible baggage of heritage, good and bad, with him. And I felt just very free. It's like my head opened, my mind opened, and I felt like this was a good place to stay for a long time. And here I am, 18 years later, in my beautiful apartment here on the Upper West Side in New York, and I still love it.
But then you got to see the best of America when you went to Las Vegas.
Right.
The Hoover Dam.
The Hoover Dam. Yes, I did. I did went to see it. And we took a helicopter ride over the canyon. Yes. I stayed only 2 months. It was the opening of the Mandalay Bay Hotel. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic to meet Chita Rivera, who actually lives here in Nyack, not very far from New York. So it was kind of a huge stage, I have to say, way too big for theater. It was this big, spectacular, Moulin Rouge stage, which needs to host a show of Cirque du Soleil or something. But we all felt a little bit lost with our very minimalist production of Chicago. But we did it, and I stayed for 2.5 months, and then I was back in New York, and then by now we are 1990, beginning of 99, I think. And and it was time after 2.5 years of Chicago to find my other voice back, to find my other stage identity, to make space and relax and not be super hyper driven, but relax into the dark.
One question about the Las Vegas production. Am I remembering this correctly? It was one of the first legit productions in Las Vegas, and that did you guys?
It was the first one in the Mandalay Bay. Yes, we opened the Mandalay Bay at the time.
And was it the same production that you played in New York, or did they cut it?
No, it was exactly the same. Artistically the same production. A different team, of course. It was a tour. It was a tour company that came to Vegas. And no, absolutely the same. Every step was the same. Every movement was the same. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what James is referring to is that until then, when they would do shows in Las Vegas and places, they would do what they called tab versions, that where they would cut them down to like an hour and 15 minutes.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the complete thing with intermission and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get back to Nine Secrets, and we'll get to number six. But tell us about.
I have to see you first, or I'm not going to talk about this. Describe yourself, please.
What are you wearing? Right.
We're all going to jump in an Uber and go up to the Upper West Side right now.
Well, we do Skype, but we only do audio, so you're safe.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm safe. Good. You are safe, too.
So tell us about how Nine Secrets started. You got together and you partnered with...
It is a journey, of course. It is actually the third record in a trilogy. The first one, I write music since the year 2000, and I've always wanted to do this. And when I did the album Punishing Kiss in the year 2000, the songs from Tom Waits and Elvis Costello and Nick Cave,
I thought this is very interesting. I'm seeing contemporary writers, rock musicians, and it's like, you know what? I can do this also. And I do play piano, and I do have a great sense of harmonic context, and I am very connected to the word, of course. And then in 2003 and 4, I wrote my own album with my own songs and my own words. And I continued doing this. And then in 2006, I became very interested in Charles Bukowski, and it was kind of a follow-up to The World of Bertolt Brecht. And I wrote an entire show, a complete show that I presented at the Public Theater, by the way, with the works and the words of Charles Bukowski. I put in music, very avant-garde jazz at the time. The next inspiration by a poet was Pablo Neruda. And that was only 4 years ago. I had by then lived through the entire repertoire of Astor Piazzolla, the great Argentinian tango composer. I loved his songs. And I had toured the world with the musicians from Buenos Aires, and I was so inspired with the collaboration with the bandoneonist Marcelo Nisiman, and we decided to collaborate on a song cycle written to the words of Pablo Neruda. This was, from the really kind of crazy, decadent, out there Charles Bukowski to the very political man who recaptured the love poems that he had written, this very, very famous cycle of love poems. And then after this, also through a lot of things that happened in my life, evolution and crises and everything, I came to read this book from Paulo Coelho. I read his books for 15 years. Of course, The Alchemist is the ultimate book that is a journey through life, and it makes you discover things in life that are just simply beautiful and simply simple, too. And then I found this new book, The Manuscripts Found in Accra. I was on tour, kind of like, oh, my heart was up and down and up my throat, and I felt like, oh, my God, what's going to happen to me? And I read this book, and it enwrapped me with this incredible perspective on life. And this, it was like a contemporary Bible without religion. Just little things that you discover about, life and love and hatred and success and abandonment and forever evolution that you can never stop, and intuition, enthusiasm, all these wonderful things that you have in your heart, and sometimes you have difficulties to be straight about them and be just connected to them. So I said, my God, this is amazing. A month later, that was in Australia on tour. A month later, I was in Sao Paulo. I do a lot of tours in South America. And I was speaking with a Brazilian journalist, said, you're Paulo Coelho, who's, of course, Brazilian. I love his books. And the journalist says, oh, my God, he's one of my oldest friends. I've interviewed him 20 times. Next day, I had an email from Paulo Coelho. Uta, I heard you like my books. I love your music. And there we are. This was the story. We started a great friendship back and forth. Finally, we met each other. And I suggested to start a song cycle on the most beautiful pearls, quotes in his book, Accra. And he approved and said, go for it, Uta. And there I went. It took me like 6 months to write the music. I recorded here in New York with great musicians. I was interested in these subjects, beauty, movement, solitude, change, fire. I was sex, of course, for you, my sweet love heart, who's listening there. But really, which is just forever. I called it surrender. I didn't even call it sex. I just then later it was the chapter sex in the book, but really it is about surrendering to something, giving in. That's really what it is at the end of the day. And that's when sex is, I guess, wonderful, if you give and take in the same way and you could just trust, and then you can go wherever you want to go, and it's great.
You're right.
Right. Yeah. And everybody stops driving now. Yes. And takes a little time out on the side of the road.
I agree. Sex is good.
Don't
at the end of the day.
Now in the studio. right. But listen, it was such an incredibly enthralling piece of work for me. I had so much fun writing it and collaborating with these musicians, these Arab musicians, musicians from Lebanon, from Israel, from the Middle East, from India, exotic musicians who bring this old wisdom of the words that Paulo Coelho treasures in his books, bring it to the music. And Gil Goldstein, you know, the absolute number one collaborator of the great jazz world, played accordion and wrote other string arrangements. And it's really a world music, a world journey through a wisdom and through beautiful philosophy of life and accompanied, you know, put into music. And you know, of course, my musical vision, which has, of course, a Western spirit to it, was great chord changes, but also a great coloring and painting by the Middle East.
So it's quite an undertaking. How long did this whole process take you from the initial thought until I guess you're going to release it in a week
now
or so?
Now in February. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, it took a year and a half, not longer, from reading the book, meeting up with Paulo, you know, excerpting the best quotes from the book and putting them into music. And then I read the books in the multiple languages, and of course, Portuguese, his mother language, in Spanish, French, and German. And I just put a few verses in each song in different languages too, because Paulo Coelho is as a legend writer. He is translated in over 45 languages. He has sold 50 million books worldwide. He is loved by so many countries of different heritage, different religion, different beliefs and different aesthetics. He's really loved by an incredible diversity of people. So I wanted to bring a little bit of this diversity into the recording too, with multiple languages. And so I just hope people will embrace it. It's a very unusual album, a concept album, and based on poetry. I mean, that almost does not exist anymore. It's kind of a very courageous step from my part. Of course, I produced it myself, the album here in New York, and it's just like this kind of gift that I make to myself, and hopefully, if it's appreciated, to the world out there.
So if folks go to your website at utelemper.com, and we'll have links to that in the show notes, you also have a YouTube channel and Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Can they listen to some of the work there?
Yes. I mean, on YouTube, you see, we've already performed this live, this Coelho show. A very important I want to mention, I have on May 13th here in Symphony Space on Broadway in New York, Uptown Broadway, my live performance of Nine Secrets. We created this live performance about a half a year ago at the big festival in Europe. And this incredible director, movie director, Volker Schlöndorff, who is actually an Oscar winner in 1980, he was with the Tin Drum and still does wonderful movies up till today. He created a panoramic, incredible backdrop to the music, 24 hours and a time frame of a desert of ruins, with ruins, old medieval ruins in North Africa. And we go from midnight, the shooting stars, over the sunrise, the day, over the sunset, and back into the midnight world. And that happens as a slow-moving movie behind us that doesn't take away from the attention of the actual sound of the music and the word, but it's a magical, magical spiritual performance all together with the music, six musicians, and this cinematography behind us. So we will perform this in New York on May 13th in the Symphony Space, and we have a lot of shows booked. And you can see a little bit on YouTube channel, because they are to television, which is the European arts channel, together with you know, the French channel. They recorded it, and we made a little teaser of that on YouTube.
Great. Well, we'll have links to all that stuff, as I mentioned before, on the show page. Uta, thank you so much for joining us on a Monday night. We really appreciate you spending some time and telling us about the Nine Secrets.
Yes, thank you so much for giving me that spot. And I just have to tell you, it is a very unusual album. And to make an album into our world of music that is so very much different and short-lived, this means a lot to me. And I hope people can appreciate that. That is an album that will make you think. Besides enjoying the music and riding on, flying with the music, it will give you incredible thoughts about life. beautiful, simple song.
Great. Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye. No what they say.
We are recording on a Monday night. The reason for that is that this weekend we had all planned to be at Broadway Con. So I made it on Friday, but I was not able to get into the city on Saturday and Sunday. But Peter, you had a book signing. I guess it was Saturday was the book signing?
Yeah. But James, you live in Long Island, and I live two avenues and two streets away from where Broadway Con was at the New York Hilton at 6th Avenue and 54th Street. Nevertheless, I took the subway because it was pretty rough out there and pretty treacherous indeed. How'd you feel about it? I have a million thoughts, but I'll let you go first.
Well, I loved it. And, you know, and I don't, because maybe it was new, it was fresh. I was really excited that there were so many people there that were excited about Broadway. And I don't know what to say about it because it was such great energy. And I've seen a handful of negative responses about it, that the audience was so young and that, you know, plays did exist before Rent and all the other types of pejorative things that people say about young theater goers, that I was once a young theater goer who saw Starlet Express many, many, many times and probably could have spent a few of those times seeing something else. But, you know, it's what I did when I was young. And I remember those days fondly. And I think that these folks who are at Broadway Con, who are big fans of Sideshow and of Wicked and of Phantom and of Rent and things like that, as they get deeper into their theatrical experience, they will discover the classic shows that we feel that should be in everybody's repertoire. But I think it was wonderful. I think it was well received. It was, you know, for all intents and purposes, sold out. And they had a very tough, unexpected weather occurrence this weekend, and they made the best of it. And I don't see anybody who was at the event that was disappointed in the turnout. And I know that, you know, we interviewed Melissa Anelli, who conceived of Broadway Con and ran the whole shebang and things like that this weekend. And, you know, I'd imagine that she's saying thank goodness for Jennifer Ashley Tepper, because it seems like Jen hosted like a number of different, she filled in for a number of people who couldn't make it there due to the closing of the subways and the closing of the trains and the streets mm-hmm. and things like that. So I really had a great time, and I thought that much of it was really great. And I especially liked the Hamilton panel. I don't know, Peter, did you get to see the Hamilton panel?
No,
it was Friday evening. I saw it right before I went to see A Mother's Be for Fair. And the panel was really, really wonderful. And they did really, they talked about Hamilton, and they talked about the handful of the actors that were there. Primarily the principals of Hamilton were there. And it was very exciting. And they played off with a sing-along with 5,000 people, plus the principals of Hamilton sang one of the songs from Hamilton. And it was great. And the audience totally knew it. And they did the thing where they stopped the music and the principal stopped singing, and the whole audience sang the rest of the verse. And it was really wonderful. I can't say enough positive things about it. Which
was there really one of the, at least one of the spaces that had that many people?
The big ballroom, the big ballroom in the Hilton, is a main floor and then a gallery, and it was packed to the room, packed to the gills, standing room only. It was just, you could not, you know, people were breathing in rhythm because that was the way to breathe. It was packed.
Wow.
And it was so much fun.
It's amazing.
It was really great. It was really wonderful. Peter, what did you think about Broadway Con? What were your thoughts?
First thing I want to say is, yes, a lot of people came up to me and said, gee, I love your books. And a lot of people came up to me and say, I read you on this site, that site, and the other thing. But the majority of people who came up to me, who recognized me, said, I love the podcasts.
That's great.
Yeah, so it really is something how these are getting out there. And so Michael and I are in your debt. You know, as they say in the musical Pickwick, we are the satellites, you are the hub. And so so we thank you amazingly for making this happen and making us famous. So we appreciate that. I agree with you entirely about this. A good time was had by all. The fact that it's been knocked because a lot of young people went, so what? It's not where you start, it's where you finish, as you pointed out. So, and you know, I felt everybody was tremendously well-behaved. Everybody was into it.
Yeah.
I like the curiosity factor, the people going around looking at these booths, learning something, finding out something, buying things, you know, all that kind of business. A lot of people were saying, oh, it's going to be ridiculous because so many people are going to dress up like their favorite characters. And there was some of that, but I don't think there was a lot of that. I don't think it was more than 2% of the crowd. I could be wrong, but it seemed to me that about 2 out of every 100 people I was seeing was dressed. And so what? You know, good luck to them. But anyway, what really surprised me, you know, I mean, the fact is that since it was such a young audience there, And considering the fact that I am old enough to know the person who invented the shoe, I was very surprised that that there would be people who would be interested in coming to hear any panel that I would be on. I was fully prepared to talk about the time when I went to a performance in Newark of The Blood Knot, which is a two-character play, and there were more people on stage than there were in the audience because I was the only one in the audience. And I was going to say to the 14 people in the room, thank you for being here, and even though there aren't many of you, we're going to go ahead and we're going to do this. So the place was packed. There was standing room. There was, you know, if you have a seat next to you that's empty, raise your hand, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, I was tremendously impressed that there was that much interest in the topic, which was, why didn't it run? Meaning, why didn't shows succeed? What were the reasons for them? So Frank DiLello was the moderator. You may know him from New York One. And Robert Viagas, the news editor from Playbill, was there as well. So the three of us talked about those issues. And it was a very responsive crowd. They were really into it. I could really feel that they wanted to hear what we had to say. They laughed in all the right places. They applauded in all the right places. They certainly applauded whenever we mentioned any show that was near and dear to them. There would be a contingency of people who agreed, you know, and it would clap wildly. So I thought it was a tremendous success. And I'm very surprised to see that people would come down on it because so many young people were there. I mean, every one of us has to be young, and every one of us, if we're lucky, gets to be old. So why should we have age discrimination?
Well, I have a question on that because I've never been to a con of any kind. I guess Comic-Con is the most famous.
Yeah, yeah.
But wouldn't they – I would think they would tend to skew young anyway.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Of course they would. You know, I mean, because it's a young person's game in essence, you know. And so if anybody picked up anything that dealt with the Golden Age musicals, fine. You know, I mean, a lot of people criticizing that there was nothing about plays there. I see that point. A lot of people criticizing there weren't panels on Golden Age shows. I see that point, too. Sure. But this is a first-time effort.
First time.
Now, granted, you know, granted, I mean, the template was in place because these people who ran this have done some of these other cons as well. And I don't mean con in a negative way. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, so we benefited from their experience that it wasn't chaos, not that I could see anyway. I didn't see anybody grumbling. I didn't see any complaints. You know, people.
I have to say, you know, I've done a number of conferences at the Hilton in that exact same space. And I want to tell you, they were top notch, and the production values were, you know, all the signage was beautiful and concise and clear, and they had a lot of staff there and people always there to help. Absolutely. A lot of staff. And what was happening on stage was amazing. And they had, because the room was so big and there were so many people in the room, they had large screen projection screens left and right of the stage on the back of the house, all throughout the inside of the auditorium as well. And as people were talking in these panels, they were transcribing and doing real-time captions on the television screens, as well as having a sign interpreter up front. I mean, I thought for a second, I was like, this has got to be being done by some sort of voice recognition computer. And because it was so fast and so good, until there was a typo that ended up on the screen during the Hamilton thing, and I won't blow it for anybody what the typo was, but everybody in the audience saw it, and the person doing the translation backspaced and wrote "oops." And I mean, I think that from managing a conference and getting that amount of people in and out and to different sessions and everything, I thought it was amazing. Well done, especially for the first one.
I'm gonna second something that you just said too about the volunteers, because I don't know how many things like this I've done. I don't think 100 is out of the estimate that would be accurate, but maybe even more. But the point is, I don't know if I've ever been to any of these things where there were so many people coming over and saying, "Do you need anything? Is there anything we can get you?" Mm-hmm. You know, and when I had a question, for example, when I first arrived, and where do I get the playbill and all that kind of stuff? "Oh, we'll get that for you. You don't have to get it for me. I'll go. You know, you're busy. You know, I mean, just tell me where." No, we're happy to. No. I mean, really, there really was a lot of bending over backwards from the volunteers. And so I think that the complaints about youth, the complaints about subject matter, all that kind of stuff, really should be taken with a shaker full of salt, because let's look at this glass as 99 and 44, 100% full, rather than the things that it didn't do.
And this is the way to build this community and make the theater stronger. And these are the people who are 14, 15, 16, 18, 20 years old that are at this thing, that are going to be in 10 years. These are going to be the people that are creating Broadway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some of them, sure. Yeah. And, you know, and who knows how many lives were changed this weekend as a result of this. So, yeah. And also, you know, it's always wonderful to be with a group of people who care about what you care about. Mm. You know, and maybe they should have been playing "No One Is Alone" over the speakers, because really, a lot of people do feel alone. You know, I talked to a lot of people who came from far out of Montana. I spoke to one person, another person from Colorado, another person from Idaho. I mean, yeah, these people came a long way. It meant a lot to them. And thank God that the snow didn't come on Friday, because a lot of people who were there for the duration, you know, were staying at the hotel or nearby hotels that were a little cheaper, to be perfectly mm-hmm. frank. And but I talked to a lot of people that were saying, "Where are you staying?" "Oh, down the street," you know, that type of thing. And nobody was particularly worried that I spoke to about the weather, because yes, they were either in this hotel or close enough that they weren't going to worry about it. So while it was terrible that it snowed on Saturday and to such a degree, thank God it wasn't Friday. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to Broadway Con 17. I mm-hmm. hope that they do mm-hmm. it again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and as far as the timing, I guess it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, January is a great time because it's kind of slow. But on the other hand, you do have the chance of bad weather. So I guess maybe they'll keep it in January and just hope for the best next time. Or maybe they'll try to move it. Whatever.
I really feel bad for the folks who might have been coming in from out of town to come to Broadway Con and had tickets to Hamilton on Saturday.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth or anything like that. But given who Lin-Manuel Miranda is, I wouldn't be surprised if he said, oh, come on, let's add an extra performance in the next couple of weeks of show, and all those people can get in to see it. Now, of course, a lot of people did come from far and wide and won't be able to return, but I'm sure a lot of the people were at least in the tri-state area and who were bitterly disappointed that this had happened, that they had to be canceled. But, you know, it's and if it doesn't happen, don't blame Lin, but my point is, I wouldn't be surprised if he spearheaded a drive to accommodate those people who were disappointed this past weekend.
I want, you know, it's been a, I'm friends with Lin on Facebook, and certainly I can't really call him a friend.
No,
I don't
sure.
really know him well, but I've known him for many years. I think that he could possibly be the hardest working person in show business, because he does this show 8 times a week, mm-hmm. and then he has a receiving line after the show. Every single show you see pictures upon pictures upon pictures of him meeting fans backstage and outside the theater and doing this. And it's just amazing how much you know, everybody on Broadway works after the show, because I'm pretty sure we all know that there's one or two stinkers out there who are really cranky and don't do anything after the show. But for the most part, fans will get to meet folks at a stage door or backstage if you're fortunate enough to get in. And he's working hard. But it was very interesting. I was going to ask Peter, tangential to the snow that we had, when's the last time the Broadway closed?
Well,
I guess 9/11.
Sandy.
Wasn't there, I think I saw something in 2012, they expected a snowstorm that was going to be a cataclysmic proportion, and they canceled in advance, but they jumped the gun that it really didn't turn out to be as bad, that really they could have gone on. But
yes, that's right.
Yeah, I did read something about 2012. So, it doesn't happen often. I mean, there's a reason we have that expression, the show must go on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we certainly understand why it didn't the other day. Certainly not.
Yeah, it was.
Well, it was kind of a really unfortunate the way the events unfolded, because, as I'm sure many people know, the matinees were not canceled until about an hour before.
Yeah,
but the reason that happened was because it wasn't until an hour before that the travel ban was announced, and the announcement of when the buses would stop running and when the subways above ground would stop running. So until that was announced, there was really they didn't really think that they needed to cancel the matinees. And so everything is dependent on everything else, and it's when something like that happens, it really is an act of God or whatever you want to call it, and you just have to make the best of it and understand that unfortunately some people are going to be tremendously disappointed.
Well, the irony for me was after I got off the subway at Columbus Circle, simply to walk the two streets, it was just so astonishing not to see a single car anywhere. Yeah. You know, I mean, that I didn't have to worry about walk, don't walk, how many seconds I had to cross the street. I had all the time I wanted to cross the street because there were no cars at all. For those people who are out of town and are wondering how we're doing in terms of this, like, should I come into the city? Is it crazy? As always, New York cleans up very, very quickly. Sure, there are feet high mounds of snow and reasonably deep puddles as well. But getting around is quite achievable, and it isn't as much of a problem as it is in so many suburban areas where it takes a long time for cars and foot traffic to just get rid of this stuff. So if you've been thinking of coming in to see a Broadway show and say, oh my God, you know, I'm just not going to be able to get there, yes, you can.
Yeah. Did you guys happen to see that YouTube video of somebody snowboarding through Times Square?
Yeah, I did, in fact. Yeah,
it's really amazing.
Sure.
All right, so let's move forward into an opening, a rare January opening of Our Mother's Brief Affair is playing Manhattan Theater Club's Samuel J. Friedman Theater. So, Michael, why don't you get us started on that?
Oh yeah, I suppose you would say a Linda Lavin vehicle, and certainly in my mind she is the reason to see it. She plays an older woman with two adult children, both of whom happen to be gay, one male and one female. And that's really they're gay just because they happen to be gay. It's not like a plot point. And I think that's one of the best. That's one of the good things about the play, that there can be characters like that nowadays, and it doesn't have to be all about that. I think that shows a real acceptance, in society at large. But anyway, so she, she's having health problems, this lady, and then at one point she reveals this affair that she has, and it turns out to be. Have been with someone of historical significance, and it really kind of knocks the kids for a loop. But then actually at the end, it turns out that perhaps her whole story is not true. So it's not even, you can take it at face value while it's happening, and I guess you're meant to, but then at the end, you have your doubts. I did not like the writing at all by Richard Greenberg. I thought it was very schematic and very disjointed, and I really didn't like it, although I didn't hate it as much as a theater professional who I ran into a couple of nights later, and I said to him, oh, you know, I saw you, but you didn't see me at Our Mother's Brief Affair, and he was like, oh my God, that was a Shonda, and he was just going on and on about how much he really, really disliked it. So I didn't dislike it as much as him, but I do think honestly, that it would not have been produced if it wasn't for Linda Lavin. And also, Richard Greenberg does have a history. Well, I mean, he has quite a few really good credits to his name. And also, he has a history with Manhattan Theater Club. But I think it was a combination of those two people that caused them to do it.
All right. Peter, what'd you think?
Well, I'm in thorough agreement with Michael about the gay issue, and I've seen a lot of people criticize it, saying, why do you make them gay? You know, well, it's really very important to have characters who just happen to be gay, and then nothing is made of it. I agree with Michael. That's another example of how the world is moving forward, the acceptance, all that. So I enjoyed that immeasurably about the play. Mm-hmm. I also agree certainly about Linda Lavin as well. I suddenly was flashing back on something with Stanley Kaufman, who was the theater critic for the New York Times in 1965-66 season. He just did it 1 year. When he reviewed Linda Lavin in It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, it was only 2 months after he had reviewed her in the off-Broadway Mad Show. Mm. So he wrote, I wish she were in every musical and review. And of course, if you talk to Linda Lavin about this, mention this, she remembers this, and she says, I think Stanley Kaufman was the brightest of all you guys, you know, and she's somewhat joking and somewhat not. But anyway, he didn't turn out to be that good a fortune teller, because if he were really good, he would have said that she's probably right for every play, too. I mean, all right, maybe not the history boys, but you know what I mean. And she really is so wonderful at these plays where she has to play a no-nonsense, I don't care what I say, let the chips fall where they may type of character. And that's who Anna Cantor is in this play. She's not ashamed to say that when she had twins, she was embarrassed for it. And one of the reasons why is a very funny line I'm not going to give away, that she likes her children by and large. You know, that's what she says, by and large. You know, so this is hardly a sentimental character. And Linda Lavin's very good at playing those. As warm as she is in real life, she really can get it out the battery acid when she needs to in a play. So, so very successful there, very successful with the gay issue. But, wow, I'm with Michael again in the fact that Greenberg pulls out the rug from under us. But the thing is, when the play is nearing the end, he tries to insert it back underneath our feet. And, yes. You know, we've just planted them too firmly in the ground by that point for him to slip it under us. I think the sticky situation stays sticky, and I think that's a problem with it. An intelligent play, eminently watchable, there is something unsatisfying as you leave the theater and you wish that it were just a little bit better. Again, not a disgrace, not a disaster, nothing like that. Just you wish it were better.
Do you guys think that this the play was expository? I felt like the characters that the brother sister were just kept on explaining to us the story, instead of us watching scenes about what has happened. Was that my imagination, or
No, that was a criticism levied about this play during previews. Certainly, the Chetwoods were saying that, and so that I didn't feel it was nearly as obtrusive as I thought it was going to be as a result of what I was reading. But I might have been stealing myself for it, given the fact that I had heard about that in advance. But no, I felt it flowed very nicely from narration to scene and back again. So I had no problem with that at all. Did you, Mike? Would you feel?
No, I didn't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But your point is very well taken about Linda Lavin. She's one of those so versatile, multi-talented people. She made her initial splash, as you say, in Broadway musicals and revues. Then she had that tremendous success as the lead in a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then she did that for however many years, and then she
nine.
Thank you. She came back to the theater, but I believe that it isn't. And she's worked constantly in the theater. But isn't it true that Gypsy is her only musical during that period?
Oh, that's very interesting. I can't think of anything else offhand.
I've seen her club act, which is great. She's done it at Birdland and maybe elsewhere.
She did A Family Affair in 1962.
Oh, yeah. But Michael's talking about more recently.
Since then, I'm looking at her credits here. Sisters Rose's Wig.
She tells me every time she runs into John Kander starts singing Harmony, which was at least the first song of the second side, maybe the first song of the second act. I don't know, of A Family Affair, that still associates her with that. And, you know, what's funny about that, you know, I mean, A Family Affair was an original cast album on United Artists Records, which rarely did original cast albums. And so on the back of the record on Harmony, they have the parentheses with the people who appear on it, and they only give last names. So it says Lavin. That's the only reference to her on the record. There's nothing on the front cover that says Linda Lavin. So, I mean, so what a way to start. Ironically enough, you know, she certainly has overcome that. What I thought was interesting in this play, to bring up another association, is that at one point her love partner asks her to dance. She says, "Oh, I can't dance. I mean, I just can't." And one of the things that won her Tony in Broadway Bound was the fact that she was talking about the time that she danced with George Raft, and she tells her kid the story of that, which she's told him many times, but he wants to hear it again because she's so wonderful when she does it. And the way the seriousness of purpose when she started getting into that story, and she knew that she was going to dance to show him what she meant, and the way she moved the chair to get it out of the way, I still can recall that. I could go to that theater and show you within a quarter inch of the stage where she was standing when she did that, because it was so memorable in the way that she did it. So yes, Linda Lavin can dance.
I'll never forget that monologue either. And let me say, I thought the high point of this play was her monologue in Act Two.
I agree.
And I'm not. It seemed like that the writing got better at that point. So maybe it did, or maybe it's just that she's that great an actress. I don't know.
He had her in mind and knows what she can do. You know what I mean?
Yes, she does monologues really, really, really well.
All right, so let's move forward. Michael saw La Boheme at the Met. Michael, which Boheme is this for you?
Uh-huh.
Oh, you mean how many?
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's this production alone. This is the beautiful Franco Zeffirelli production, which debuted in 1981 and is one of the very few that old that are still in the Met's repertoire, because I think they realize that, you know, people love it so much. They're going to hang on to it as long as they can. It's so amazing. When Act One is very intimate, as it should be, but beautiful looking. Act Two is set, Act One is set in the Garrett apartment. You know, it's supposed to be like a little confined space up in the the attic of this building in Paris. But then Act Two is the Latin Quarter out on the street on Christmas Eve. And I swear, when the curtain goes up, it seems like there are 300 people on stage. It's just – I know, Peter, that you said when you went to Merry Widow that you were a little disappointed at the lack of lavishness of the production. If you want to see lavish, go see Bohème or Turandot at the Met. They're both Zeffirelli productions, and they're both amazing. One of the main reasons I went back was to see the soprano, Ye Kyung Hong, who has been singing at the Met for quite some time now, but not a lot recently. I think she's sort of towards the mature part of her career. But I have loved her so much for years that I just wanted to hear her and see her again as Mimi in La Bohème, and she did not disappoint. I think she's the greatest. And I'm going to get to see her in Madame Butterfly in a few weeks at the Met, which will be – it's not that often that you get to see an actual Asian person as Madame Butterfly. So that's going to be really special. She is Korean. And I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this, but you know, we talk about colorblind casting, alternative casting, multicultural casting on Broadway. Opera has been doing it for a really long time. In this production, Ye Kyung and one of the other major singers were both from South Korea. The tenor is from France. The other major singers, one is from Hawaii, one is from Texas, and one is from Alabama. And the conductor was from Israel. So it really kind of adds to the enjoyment to know that all of these people from all of these different cultures are coming together to perform this really beautiful, classic, famous Italian opera set in Paris. it's kind of like a huge, beautiful melting pot. And I was just really, really happy to be there.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And as we talked about a few weeks ago, you can get reasonable tickets. If you want to venture out to the Met, check out their beautiful, gorgeous website.
And I went with my sister. It was her. She had called me a few weeks ago and said, you know, I'd like to see an opera, you know, just to have the experience. She said, is there one that's like kind of not that opera-ish? That's what she said. I said, I don't know about that, but I said La Bohème is really, it's really quite short, and it's, you know, it's famous for many reasons. It's in Moonstruck, which I know she is a movie that she loves. So we went, and she adored it. And then I said, I asked her how she loved it, how she liked it, and she said she really did. And then when we had the snow the other day, I called her because it's actually snows on stage in La Bohème in Act Two. In Act Three, excuse me. A really beautiful, beautiful scene. And I said, is the snow reminding you of the Met the other night? And she said, yeah, I'm going to go sit on a bench somewhere and cough.
Oh, yeah. Michael, I was just going to ask you if you reviewed on Broadway Radio the Broadway production of La Bohème, but that was long before we started Broadway Radio. Tell us, what'd you think of the Broadway production in 2002?
Oh, I thought it was really great. That was the Baz Luhrmann production.
Yeah.
That was the one Broadway show that I have ever missed the curtain for, because I was with someone who kind of made me miss the curtain, and I won't get into that.
they are now dead.
But it's memorable to me for that reason. But then I went back. They were nice enough to accommodate me to go back. And I thought it was great. The cast was fantastic. Alfie Beau was one of the Rodolfos. And he's doing what is he doing now?
Les Mis. I saw him Friday Mis. Night.
Yes. I thought so. Right.
I saw him Friday night, in fact, and I think he may be the best Saint Valjean I've ever seen.
Really?
I did go back while James was at Our Mother's Brief Affair. I was down the street at Les Mis because one of my CCM students, Adam Monley, was in playing Javert. I still think the production's in excellent shape. Excellent shape. So I do recommend if you want to return visit or you've never seen it. I don't know if we have many listeners who fit into that category, but still, I was tremendously impressed by how well it moved. And boy, still a great show. Still a great show.
No, he was great. And but wasn't Ben Davis in that Lava Wim?
Ben Davis, Marcello, yeah.
Yes, yeah. No, it was a wonderful production at the Broadway Theater, which was a good place for it, size-wise. And I really enjoyed it very much.
And this played for, I'm looking at IBDB, it played 228 performances. So has anything ever played 228 performances over the course of 30 years at the Met, you know?
Well, you know, that was what a lot of people brought up when Porgy and Bess played originally on Broadway in 1935. I think it only ran something like
125, well, I think.
125, yeah, which really doesn't sound like much even in those days. But if they did it at the Met or any other opera company, they would do like two, maximum three performances a week, you know, in rotation with other things. So it would take them many years to equal that. So it's just not comparable in that way.
And the Broadway Bohème, they had lots of Mimis, lots of Rodolfos. They had this very complex, almost had like some sort of apparatus that could figure out how to see which cast with which thing on which night. You know, it was very complex.
I remember. I went twice. Yeah, so.
And there is a video that was done before that. Baz Luhrmann had done a production in Australia of the opera. So if anyone is interested, that's still gettable, I'm sure. And it kind of gives an idea of what his concept was for the piece, which a lot of it actually was recycled from Moulin Rouge, the film.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So opulent productions at the Met, and then you you went over to the where were you, the Japanese ambassador's home tonight?
Yes, I was at the home of the Japanese ambassador on East 67th Street because to celebrate the 100th performance of Trip of Love at Stage 42, because that show has a lot of Japanese producers and money behind it. And I was glad to be there because I really enjoyed the show. Regardless of what I didn't like about it, the dancing and the choreography and a lot of the singing in it is really quite extraordinary, not to mention the amazing, amazing sets and projections and costumes. So I was happy to be there. There were several cast members there, Austin Miller, Laurie Wells, and a few others, and they did a little performance. And I it's the kind of show I hope it does find its audience.
Michael, what was the mood of the place? Was it celebratory, or was it like the party in All About Eve, where Strum is playing, you know, mournfully?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I'll be honest with you. About three different people spoke, and all of them mentioned the bad reviews. You know, you know, but in kind of like, I mean, actually, I was glad that they were honest about it and didn't try to pretend it didn't happen. But then one of them made the point, you know, which has been made before, that things like Wicked and, you know, I think Phantom originally, you know, did not get really good reviews. So it
certainly not commensurate with the run as Phantom begins year 29 tomorrow, right? Isn't it? Begins year 29. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, so you know, there should be room for that kind of thing, but it's there's just so much product in going on right now, and even after we have the I guess the January weeding out, I guess maybe that will help a little bit in terms of just clearing the decks, but then of course we'll have 20, 30 new shows opening in the next few months, so
yeah. And you'll hear about all of them here. One of them that is going to be coming up is Hello Dolly with Bette Midler. Tell the listeners about this, Peter.
Well, it's still a year away. You know, let's hope she's still alive. Let's hope we all are.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
No, I mean, well, really, no,
it's
time.
It's true.
I guarantee you that there are going to be people a year from now who will be dead that we didn't expect to be. So any one of us could be. You know? Mm-hmm. So, but boy, there is a lot of excitement over there, isn't there? And I'm hoping that this will be a type of renaissance for traditional musicals, that people will go and say, "Gee, you know, these old fashioned shows are pretty good," you know. So I'm hoping that will happen. And the report's saying that she's getting $150,000 a week at the minimum. That's pretty amazing. And that's got to be the all time high salary, isn't it? I've never heard of one higher than that. Plus a piece of the action. And I mean, you know, so that's really something. So she better be there for 8 a week. That's all I can say. But
yeah. And if not, I don't know how they're going to finesse that. That'll be interesting to see.
It will be, you know. But sure, she's right for the part. And people are saying, "Oh, she's so old now." Nah, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't. I mean, that character is better old, as the movie proved to us a long time ago. You're better off with an older dolly than a younger one. It makes more sense. It is about, you know, your last chance and before the parade passes by. So under those circumstances, older is not a liability with Dolly. And Dolly's such a wonderful show because it has so many wonderful positive messages, even down to Dolly saying, "My husband was a pleasure-loving man." And it brings up the point that, you know, we should all be pleasure-loving people. You know, pleasure's good stuff. Or,
yes, and she says even when times were bad.
Right.
You know, yes. every Saturday night we would come down those steps at the Harmonia Gardens and dance the night away.
That's right. To quote a big Broadway flop of years ago, Rosa, there's a line in it, "When you have money, save it. When you don't have money, spend it." And I understand the logic behind that. Anyway, Irene Malloy saying, you know, "Oh, Dolly, the world is full of wonderful things. Has there ever been a simpler line that packs as much of a wallop as that one does?" It really is quite terrific. And yes, I do believe that money is like manure and you should spread it around. So Dolly's a good show. And It's certainly going to be welcome back to my eyes, certainly.
Rumor has it that it's going to be welcome back to the St. James Theater, where the original production had its entire run.
Yeah, there used to be a plaque out in front saying that. That plaque isn't there anymore.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was there for a while, but one day it was gone. Yeah, you can come and search my house. It ain't here. I'm innocent. But anyway, always at the St. James. And yes, it would be sentimentally nice to be back again. I tell you, if I were living in New York during that period of time, I would have seen all those ladies. The only ones I saw were Carol Channing, Ginger Rogers, and Pearl Bailey. And I don't know anybody who saw Phyllis Diller who didn't think she was terrific, which doesn't sound logical. And speaking to Phyllis Diller about it once, she did say to me, "I didn't do any of my trademark fang type stuff. I just played it straight." And that's what people really admired about her. So so who knows? Maybe this will start another 6-7 year run that will mean that we have some great stars taking over as Dolly, as David Merrick did back in from 64 to 70. I think that'd be great.
The only person I saw, as I'm sure I mentioned, was Merman. So that was pretty amazing.
And then I
did see, of course, I saw Channing in both revivals. And then I saw that tour that Pearl Bailey brought back to Broadway.
Oh, yeah. That was supposed to be really cheap.
It was pretty cheap. Yeah. But it was still fun. It was great to see her.
Sure. Play. Sure. Speaking of Merman, I was at the launch for Merman's Apprentice, the musical that Stephen Cole and David Evans wrote, which is really terrific. Clea Blackhurst plays Merman and a tremendously talented girl named Elizabeth Teeter. You may remember her daddy, Lara, who was in On Your Toes 30-odd years ago. Tremendous. About Ethel Merman taking a little kid under her wing, and the album just got released, and it is really great show music, and I really recommend it very highly. So, and the whole point revolves, the time is set when Merman is doing Dolly, so it's really very relevant to what we're talking about now. Even though
and Clea Blackhurst, who also did an excellent job as Dolly,
thoroughly agree at Goodspeed. Yep.
Yes, like a year or two ago.
Sure. Yeah. Terrific job. Wonderful. And of course, a lot of people have been talking about Van de Gelder, and it's fine with me if Tony Sheldon from Goodspeed gets it. And it's fine with me if Louis J. Stadlin, who I saw opposite Leroy Reams, gets it. Both of them were excellent. So we'll see what happens there. But I certainly will cast my electoral votes for either one of those gentlemen to get the part.
Definitely. Yeah, Louis Stadlin would be – I could just picture him in that.
He's fabulous. He really,
he'd be so great.
Yeah, it's not a false move. Everything he did was great. So there.
All right. 1 minute, 60 seconds before we wrap up for the evening. I want to hear just 60 seconds, maybe even 30 seconds for each one of you guys. Mm-hmm. Ken Davenport has a podcast interview with Ken Billington. Mm-hmm. That was released today, and I listened to it, and Ken Billington said something that I want to get your opinion on. He said that he would like to come back to the point where reviewers attend shows on opening nights and write their reviews that evening. Is it possible?
I think it's a very bad idea, frankly. And I will tell you that thousands of reviews that I've written, when I've come home from the theater and I'm really furious about something, the next morning when I get up after a night's sleep and taking a shower, I'm not as angry. So I think reviews could really be far more caustic if indeed they were written right in the heat of the moment. Also, why shouldn't we have enough time to make them as good as we possibly can make them? So, and the time constraint is taken off. And finally, don't they need those seats for the investors now on opening night?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so that's another thing, too.
Michael, I also think it's a terrible idea. Did he say why he thought
he felt that that reviewers are reviewing a show that might not be fully baked yet, and that they felt that reviewers should be there with the excitement of an opening night. And he talked about how when Sweeney Todd was being done, that Hal Prince had asked the reviewers to come on a Wednesday before to see it and then come back to opening night and then write their review. Because he felt like people, he wanted them to have some time to process Sweeney Todd, but also he wanted them to be there when it was finished and when the excitement of the audience was there.
Well, two things come to mind immediately. I remember a week before City of Angels opened, Michael Blakemore, the director, said to me, I'm freezing it tomorrow. So, I mean, I imagine many of them do. So what difference does it possibly make? Secondly, I remember Harvey Sabinson, who was David Merrick's press agent for a number of years, making this claim, saying, bring back the glamour of opening night. And I said, Harvey, it's glamorous for you because you're there, because you're an insider. It doesn't matter to most everybody else, the glamour of opening night. You just want to feel like you're at an important event, and that's all there is to it. Why is that important in the grand scheme of things? It's much more important that reviews be as cogent, inclusive, and fair-minded as they possibly can be, and I think time helps that to happen.
Yeah, and they still have their parties for the openings.
Sure.
I don't really understand his point, because I don't need to tell either of you that there are far many more previews now than there were back in the day.
That's true.
When critics did review on opening night. So it's really just a question of what you call it. I mean, if a show isn't ready after 3 or 4 weeks of previews, then I don't know what to say.
Well, to be fair, all those previews are in place of an out-of-town tryout, but most out-of-town tryouts tended to be 3 or 4 weeks, which is, as you say, what previews tend to be now. There's not much different. I mean, there was certainly in the 50s and 60s, they'd do 1 or 2 previews, and that would be the end of it, and then they'd open. But
of course, a lot of shows, even if they don't have a pre-Broadway tour, which most don't anymore, they have been done in one way or another beforehand.
Yes, that's right.
Or transfers from London or off Broadway.
That's good. No, you're right. The workshops, the regional theaters. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
Well, if you are interested in the process of lighting, or even just in the process of a point of view of a lighting designer, listen to Ken Davenport's podcast this week with Ken Billington, the lighting designer, and it's really very interesting. I highly recommend it.
But as much as I disagree with him, let me say he is a great lighting designer.
Oh, just tops.
Sure.
All right. Before we get on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app. The Stitcher app is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream us directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do we have an answer to last week's trivia question?
Yeah, what I asked last week is that Che Rivera and Carol Channing had something in common in terms of Tonys. They don't have the same number of Tonys, no, but they had something in common. And the answer, which I have to say Michael got immediately after we went off the air, was the fact that both were nominated for Best Actress in a Musical for roles they had played before, but in different contexts, because Carol Channing was in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, but then was nominated for playing Lorelei Lee in Lorelei, the revisal of it. And Che Rivera played Rosie in Bye Bye Birdie and then played Rosie in Bring Back Birdie, for which she got a nomination as well. So that was the answer to that one. The next one, okay. Two people who died in 1947 eventually appeared in two musicals that opened within a week of each other. Who were these guys and who were the musicals?
There's only one person you can count on now. All right. So if you know the answer to those things, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will see if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I've always known I am my own best friend. Babies are life, but babies alone. Best friend. Many's the guy who told me he cares, but they were scratching my back, 'cause I was scratching theirs. Luck. That's only for fools. I play in a game where I make the rules. And rule number one, from here to the end, is I am my own best friend. Three Musketeers. Every test.